that's Valkyrie.
Does he design the games?
No, he executes them.
Valkyrie, driver 41, ready to download.
Sega Saturn.
Hey, you.
It'll be this good. Thanks, Sega. Thanks.
Hello and welcome to another Sega Guys podcast. You're here with me. It's the D to the A to the N to the D, Dan Driver, here again. And I'm here with the Wolf Hawkfield to my Jeffrey McWild. It's James. How you doing, James?
Oh, this sounds a super adventure. Oh, well, I know after the last episode you were disappointed I didn't do a yo-yo for the gum and beat, but I mean, unless you want me to do a grunting Canadian wrestler's suplex sound effect, then I don't think there's much I can add to the Wolf Hawkfield part, but I'm smashing, mate. How's yourself?
Not too bad, mate. Not too bad. You know, it's pretty much the same as we say every time we do one of these. Now, how you doing, mate? Still in lockdown, yeah? Still in lockdown.
Still in lockdown, still working from home.
Well, what have you been playing the past couple of weeks?
Well, apart from, obviously, Cyberpunk on the Series S, the ye olde faithful. I've been playing a lot of Sega Rally. I was on a Speedruns website.
Yeah,
I sent you the link. It was a French boy who just put this ridiculous time up on the PC version. I thought I was good at the game, but my god, I am so far off the pace when it comes to the time that boy set. But looking to pick up some tips, I was on there and I must have hit restart about 36 times before giving it up for the evening. It just wasn't happening at all. And I've been playing some kind of Mega Drive stuff as well. The thread I put out on Twitter was looking at games that were on the Mega Drive after being on the Amiga, so stuff like Leander, which is obviously called Legend of Galahad on the Mega Drive, Zool, Turrican, obviously Mega Turrican, which is a kind of crossover, not so much a crossover of 1 and 2 or a mix of that, but its own kind of game with the same kind of visual style.
Yeah.
Lotus Turbo Challenge, Chuck Rock, Cannon Fodder, so... interesting going through and playing these games again for the first time in, God, almost 30 years since I've played some of these games. Where the hell was that time went?
Yeah.
So I've been kind of a wee bit of mix and matched of everything. The Dreamcast is sitting there feeling a wee bit neglected, I think, so I might need to give that some love soon. It's been kind of left to the wayside with the Saturn stealing most of the attention, which... takes us on nicely to the topic of today's show. We are going to delve into why Bernie Stolar, in our opinion, was wrong. And the Saturn was, he said to say, obviously, famously, the Saturn is not our future. We're going to tell you guys today, listeners, why the Saturn was Sega's future.
Absolutely. So, I mean... there was a lot of anger about Bernie saying this back in 1997. I think we should probably just say right now that this isn't going to be a Bernie Stolar hit piece. We're not going to start digging Bernie out. He did great stuff for the launch of the Dreamcast. And I can't imagine that was his decision, was to kill time on the Saturn at that point. But unfortunately, he said the line. So unfortunately, he's the one that lives in infamy. That's why Mr. Stolar gets the headline in this episode's title.
All these years later. the expression that mud sticks really does come to mind, and as you say, much like the Tom Kalinske, shotgun launch of the Saturn, the E395, I think this decision would have come from higher up, but as you say, mate, it's pretty much stuck with Bernie, just by the fact that he was the man to stand on the stage and deliver that line. As you said and you alluded to there, the job he did with the Dreamcast was and the American launch was fantastic. We know there was a lot of kind of politics as well that led to him leaving that post, and then obviously Peter Moore took over, and that's a whole new era. But Yeah, it won't be a hit piece, not at all. It will be perfectly reasoned. We've been talking about this quite a bit on WhatsApp and different kind of points and angles and kind of opinions that we've got. So yeah, let's get going.
Yeah, so it kind of follows up from a piece that we put on the Sega Guys WordPress site, which was whether the Saturn could have continued. And I think when we started talking about it from there, didn't we, whether this would make a good episode. And it does kind of tie into what we said all the way back on the Sega Guys Go Sega Gaga on, you know, keeping the Saturn alive. So it's, hopefully our listeners find this one an interesting one. Because Saturn's, it's got an odd history to it, because there seems to be an accepted narrative around what the console was and how it fared. And, you know, everyone views it as this massive shit show from the very beginning, which is pretty far from the truth. Because I remember it being this sort of mystical, crazily, you know, premium piece of hardware back in the day. I remember, you know, there's various previews. I've been doing some digging around a lot of the history of the Saturn in recent months, and looking at some of the old magazine scans with the old concept art and everything like that. I remember thinking it was such a, you know, I had my Mega Drive. I really wanted a Mega CD. Couldn't afford that. Really wanted a 32X when that came out. And I thought that was the way that was going to go, because that seemed like a really wallet friendly solution to go 32-bit, you know, to get the polygonal games that it promised. Obviously the 32X, we won't go into too much detail on, but I thought that was going to be where I go. The Saturn to me seemed too expensive. But there was a lot of excitement around it. I mean, I don't know how you remember it, James, but there was a lot of excitement in any of the press that you saw.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I've touched on the kind of WordPress site that we've got as well, the piece on there, my history with the Saturn's kind of obviously well known, and I'll not regurgitate too much of it. I always going to tell that story again. But I mean, as back then, being an Amiga gamer and kind of being really focused on the regret of not having a Mega Drive, console gaming was a very alien concept to me, so I wasn't someone who paid attention to other format magazines. Obviously internet wasn't a thing that we had, you know, back then. It wasn't, yeah. I mean, the top of 95, it wasn't anywhere near what we've got today, wall-to-wall gaming coverage. So it was whenever, obviously, my uncle got the launch day model and playing it that day. So, and what you said about obviously the premium feel of it, and it still rings true today. The console, especially the Mark One, with that beautiful glass effect front with the opaque buttons, the elliptic buttons, sorry, the oval buttons, and the power and access light are kind of hidden under the glass, and the light through, you know, whenever it's off, you don't see them. It just looks like a very high end piece of equipment.
It does.
And when you compare that to, obviously, the PlayStation that came out, it seems odd that the Saturn is almost written off as, well, first as a failure and as a toy, and the PlayStation is viewed as the adult, you know, gaming console, or adult, you know, coming-of-age kind of gaming console, that took it down a lifestyle route, which, in effect, it did with some of the marketing and the kind of the music tie-ins, Prodigy and things like that, the kind of club scene. But the PlayStation very much looks and feels like a toy, you know. Yep. It's far cheaper built. So, yeah, but my first impression seeing it was obviously all at Virtua Fighter running in the house, which I just couldn't believe I was actually seeing with my own eyes. And then obviously just the build quality. It was just an absolutely gorgeous machine.
Yeah, it really is still such a stunning machine. And Andrew Dickinson of Dreamcast Years and Dreamcast got that gorgeous looking Japanese model recently. Yes. And it's absolutely, I mean, I love the Japanese model, and I love the black Western versions. I think it's a gorgeous looking machine still. But it's funny that you mention the price and the PlayStation being cheaper. I mean, yeah, I completely agree. The PlayStation does feel a lot more plasticky, especially more than the Model 1 Saturn. The great big circular buttons, you know, I don't want to sound too much like a fanboy or something, but it does look like a Fisher Price console or something. I mean, I do like the PlayStation. I do own one. I've got a bunch of games that I love for it. But the console, the look of the console itself, you compare the two side by side, I think the Saturn is obviously, you know, we're biased, spoilers, we're the Sega guys, but it's, I feel like the Saturn really does look like a premium piece of kit. But I mean, it goes far beyond what they look like, because the PlayStation, as we may touch on later, was a lot cheaper to produce. I believe that, you know, I was reading that the Saturn cost $380 to manufacture in America.
Jeez.
Whereas the PlayStation only cost $300. So that was part of the reason why retailers were, why the price was so high, why there was the, you know, $299 line at E3. Because Sony could sell the PlayStation, you know, at cost effectively and make money back on the software. Whereas the Saturn was, their retailers were only making $20 on the machine. And if Sega had to cut the price, you know, they were onto a loser. It's because the Saturn had such more, had the more complex hardware, the two. And I don't think it's any secret that the Saturn was extremely difficult to develop for as a result of its architecture, because, you know, two VDPs and two CPUs was not common in the console space at that point. You know, if you look at arcade boards, then yeah, that sort of setup was pretty much very commonplace. You'd see that in all sorts of arcade boards. When it came to hardware in the console space, yeah, it was pretty exotic. So yeah, that's part of the reason why it costs so much more than the PlayStation.
And it also explains why it was Sega who got the very best out of it.
Yeah, that, indeed.
You know, they were used to that particular setup. They were used to developing for, you know, those multiple CPUs and VDPs. So they were used to that technology, that layout. Whereas 3D gaming was very much, you know, again, in its infancy. Whenever these machines came out, you know, you're talking about, we were making the transition from 2D to 3D. So not only were developers learning, but it was a brand new technology as well. So Sega had that experience in the arcade to be able to actually bring these titles, you know, to the home, and they were used to it. So yeah, the architecture definitely did have a major say, both in the cost and the performance of the console that you were seeing, especially from third parties. But it still doesn't excuse many of the misconceptions and misrepresentations, a lot of revisionism as well around the Saturn, you know, that this extra processor was just tossed in at the end, you know, in a blind panic, like they kind of had all the boxes lined up, open them up, taking a chisel and flicking the cover off, right, fire that other chip in there, get the soldering iron. It wasn't as dramatic as, and there is an element of truth that they did see what the PlayStation was going to be doing in terms of 3D, and they did try to, you know, compensate for that. But I think the kind of the narrative that's spun is a wee bit further from the truth.
No, that's absolutely, because there's a few misconceptions that we'll probably tackle when we're discussing this, but the hardware absolutely is one. There's this common phrase that, oh, the Saturn wasn't designed for 3D. It was conceived as a 3D console from the very start. The entire makeup of the machine was to be a hybrid System 32 Model 1 machine. I read things and I see things, and people do say, oh, they added the new video display processor at the end. But that couldn't be further from the truth. The console was designed with two video display processors, simply because that's how the Model 1 worked. In the Model 1 board, you had a video display processor which did all the polygon moving. It generated the fires and the ring and everything else. And then you had the second processor, the video display processor, which generated the 2D backgrounds and all the 2D text and everything like that. So the Saturn really was designed to mimic Model 1 hardware. I think the unfortunate thing is that Model 1, you know, 3D hardware was moving so quickly at that point. We had, in the home, we had, say, the Atari Jaguar, we had the 3DO, and in the arcade, I think the Model 1 was, you know, we had Virtual Racing, what, 91, 92? And in 1993, we had Daytona USA. But, yeah, as you say, mate, they did put in the additional CPU. It was definitely, it was a CPU that was put in, not not a video display processor. The CPU was added in response to rumors that Sega had heard about the PlayStation, and it wasn't because the Saturn couldn't do 3D. It could do 3D, but when it was calculating the geometry of the polygons, one processor wasn't enough. And because they had the deal with Hitachi, rather than, you know, break away, create a deal with someone else, you know, maybe put Hitachi in a bad position. We don't want another, you know, NEC Voodoo 3DFX issue that they had with the Dreamcast. rather than replacing the chipsets, out they decided to put another CPU in and work them in parallel. So yeah, it's there's a lot of misconceptions, false information that you see sometimes around the Sega Saturn, but it really was a 3D machine. Maybe not first and foremost, but it was definitely designed with 3D in mind. The additional CPU was put in, you know, to add a little bit more grunt to increase polygon generation, but everything else that VDP1 does, you know, the polygon generation, the way that it texture maps sprites and everything, that was there from the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of best examples, when you look at Saturn games, I think, you know, Panzer Dragoon Zwei is a great example of, you know, the sprawling backgrounds that you see. You know, the draw distance you get on that game is ridiculous. It goes so far. You know, one of the best looking Sega Saturn games you can buy. And the sprawling backgrounds you get on that, the draw distance, as I say, as weird as it sounds, Athlete Kings is another one that shows off, you know, the VDP to whenever you're panning around the arenas and you see the rest of the kind of the field away in the distance, and you get the stands and all that. I mean, that's all VDP2 that's doing all that, all the kind of background work. So it's quite a clever setup, you know, that you had, you know, one chip to handle the parts that would move on screen. Obviously, as you said, your fighters, your cars, your kind of, well, Sega Rally, like your the actual track itself, the mountains, the mud piles outside the track, your checkpoint flies, all that kind of stuff. But obviously, the background stuff beyond that, building on that, and the background was VDP2.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is a very clever design if you can make the most of it. I think the thing that held it back was not the VDP setup. Because you could do really good things with that setup. You've seen when it's been in the hands of developers that have understood the console, that it's done some amazing things. It's just the dual CPU setup was problematic because it was fairly common in Japanese arcade board because that's how games were coded on it in arcades with multiple chipsets. But Western developers were a little bit cold on the idea. They weren't as familiar with it, and I think that did kind of play into some of Tom Kalinske's fears. I think I've seen a few interviews with him where he did express concern around the setup of the Saturn, because he didn't think that Western developers would find it too approachable. And if you look at Sega's output on the Saturn, he was kind of right, unfortunately. But the system was powerful. I think a lot of the games hold up extremely well now, especially if they you know, you look at Virtua Fighter 2 in the Saturn's high res mode, Last Bronx, Panzer Dragoon Zwei, as you said, Athlete King still looks phenomenal. It really is a fantastic system. When
how could you rattle off games and not say Sega Rally? You try to hurt my feelings here. Come on.
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. Forgive me. 1,000 apologies.
But I mean, the launch of the system then, mate. So, you know, again, despite this tag of, you know, being a flop and a failure, the Saturn still remains Sega's Japanese savior, for lack of a better term. It is the best-selling domestic console. And at launch, was it 170,000 units?
Yeah, it's interesting, the Japanese at launch, because Sega they had their eyes firmly on PlayStation in Japan. And I think the PlayStation launched a week or two later. The rumours were that the Saturn had 500,000 consoles, but they only put 200,000 or something on pre-release. They all sold out in 2 weeks. You couldn't even pre-order them before launch. This was the strength of Virtua Fighter at the time in Japan. It was such a cultural phenomenon that it basically sold the Saturn itself. But then they held back 300,000 units. So when the PlayStation did arrive on the scene 2 weeks later, all of a sudden there was this other restocking of Sega Saturn consoles. It was pretty much outselling the PlayStation from then, and the PlayStation wouldn't catch up for nearly 3 years.
Crazy. And all off the back of a certain RPG.
Yeah, if Final Fantasy VII wasn't on PlayStation, who knows, the Saturn may have continued to outsell the PlayStation in Japan. But it managed to outsell the N64 overall. It's funny that that Final Fantasy VII just erased the Saturn's lead pretty much overnight, such was the furore over that game. But the Japanese launch was so successful, which is why I believe Nakayama wanted Tom Kalinske to launch the Saturn as soon as possible.
Mm. So probably looking at it and thinking, right, we've got them with the balls here in Japan, so to say. Because, I mean, you look at it at the end of 1994, Sega had sold 500,000 Sega Saturns. That's sold, yeah. Not shipped. 500,000, 50,000 of those were V Saturns. And it was 300,000 PlayStations were sold, at the same period, with Sega planning to triple that figure by Christmas 95 to 1.5 million units. So, you know, the early signs were very good. Again, this is all kind of figures and, you know, things that don't get mentioned. You know, everybody focuses on, you know, the kind of the Western, and we're not trying to kind of sugarcoat things too much here. There were mistakes made. Let's not kid ourselves. We're not denying that, but what we're trying to kind of do, guys, is kind of rewrite a little bit the kind of narrative and the kind of revisionism that goes on around the system. And that Japanese launch period shows that, I mean, the Japanese were taken to the system big time.
Yeah, I think they'd sold 1 million consoles by mid-1995 in Japan. And for Sega never having a success in Japan in terms of console sales, you can see why they were eager to get it out, and you can kind of understand both points, really, because Sega of Japan were eager for it to go into America, as that was their most successful market, whereas Sega of America, first of all, they were pushing the 32X in 1994, they were still concerned around the cost of the unit, which is, as we said, but we did have that launch in America, the infamous surprise launch, which is interesting because in a way that it did drum up a lot of interest for the console. I know everyone says that it was an absolute disaster, and in some ways it was, because, and I didn't notice until I saw Console Wars, James, but the American market just seems to be, or at that point seemed to be, very toy market driven.
Yes.
Yeah. So I remember reading about KB Toys not stocking the Saturn and saying after that surprise launch they'll never stock it. And I was thinking, who are they?
They're massive over there.
Yeah. It wasn't until I saw Console Wars, I thought, wow, they're out pretty big, so that was a big deal. So obviously the surprise launch had ramifications for you know, the stockists of the system.
And when you think as well, mate, sorry, that again, yeah, watching Console Wars, if you look at the steps that Kalinske took with the Genesis Mega Drive, where they set up a makeshift Sega store outside the main Walmart.
Yep.
Because obviously, like, Nintendo dominated the retail space in the kind of terms and conditions of that.
Yeah.
And they were trying to get some kind of shelf space in a high street essentially a high street store. And they had this little Sega store set up right outside the main Walmart, and they were basically big signs up, you know, play Genesis here, and, you know, crowds of kids coming in, again, kids, you know, even though they were trying to kind of target the young adult, the kind of like teens, mid, you know, kind of early to mid, late teens, they had queues and queues of kids, and eventually that's what swayed Walmart to give Sega some shelf space. So, Kalinske obviously knew, you know, the guy came in and worked wonders with the Genesis, so he knew the vitality of having, you know, that retail deal in place. So that's what makes it even stranger, and what makes you, you know, there's this kind of, I don't, we'll never really know unless, you know, you speak to Tom or, you know, someone from Sega Japan, but you don't know who it came from, you know, to make that launch early. I mean, was it the Japanese because of the success in Japan, or did Sega of America decide, well, let's go? I'm kind of leaning towards Japan, telling them they had to do it, and not giving, you know, Sega of America quite the time to do those deals, because, you know, KB Toys were massively burnt. They were not amused at all at being cut out of the loop. And that's what makes me think that it could not have been a Kalinske or Sega of America decision to do that, because they knew too well. They had fought too hard to get retail space for Sega in America in the previous generation. I can't see them being naive enough to just go, ah, just release it and don't include them.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, I've seen, you know, Console Wars, it's heavily implied that Nakayama wanted the early launch. But then I've read a interview with Tom himself, and he said that he knew that he had the mandate to release it early. So obviously he had to release it early from Nakayama, but it was his idea to do the surprise launch. So who knows, mate? Maybe we need to get Tom on the show and ask him ourselves.
I have tweeted him. He rubbered me, but, you know, I won't give up. I will have someone from Sega on this podcast one day, mate.
The launch itself, I mean, the Saturn was an immediate sellout in America. I mean, obviously there was the PR issue and the issue with losing KB Toys, but I mean, it sold well, and it was remained sold out until the official launch day, which was frustrating. I mean, they were eking top consoles out, but the problem is that they had a lot of demand in America, but they also had unprecedented demand in Japan. I mean, in Japan, they were going from strength to strength, going, I think, 1.5 million consoles before the year was out, maybe even 2 million from memory. But in America, yeah, it may have sold even more had it not had stock issues, and it was selling well until the PlayStation landed.
Yeah, I mean, the thing as well about the launch is that with it being brought forward, it was meant to be September, you know, in the Western region. You know, Sega, was it Saturn Day?
Saturn Day, yeah.
Which is obviously the kind of now infamous, you know, Twitter hashtag Saturn Day, on everybody's at Saturday, right? Get that off the shelf. Take a picture of it.
Guilty.
Get on there with a hashtag. Sega Saturday. But I mean, the games that came out at launch, right? Virtua Fighter and Daytona take their fair flack, right? I think the Virtua Fighter port is great, but maybe that's just because of that kind of nostalgia And I play it today and I still love it. And again, it's maybe because of that whole history that I've got with, that was the game I loved in the arcade, and the game that came with the Saturn launch and all that kind of thing. But if you look at the games that came out at the tail end of 95 and very early 96, you know, the big three.
Yeah.
If they had just delayed the launch 3 months instead of bringing it forward 3 months, I always wonder what could have been different.
Yeah. Yeah, we said this on the on our Sega Gaga video.
We did.
And, you know, I think part of the thing about, sometimes a console comes in, if it looks better than what's out there, the preconception changes. I think Ridge Racer versus Daytona, obviously Daytona had the clip-in, and Ridge Racer was a very good port on the PS1, so straight away, people were saying, well, yeah, the Saturn can't do 3D. but then if you release it in, you know, December 1995 with Virtua Fighter 2 with Sega Rally and Virtual Cop, all three of which looked much better than anything the PlayStation had at the time, there was nothing in the PlayStation library to look like Virtua Fighter 2 for ages. You know, who knows? It could have it could have sold a lot more. It could have been, the preconception could have been different, and it could have been demanded a premium and been a success. But yeah, unfortunately, as it was, as soon as the PlayStation came out, it was outselling the Sega Saturn 2-1, which is, I suppose, where we get into Bernie's line. Because
yes, yeah,
1995, yeah, it's the Saturn's being outsold. I think it was close. I think it was around 2-1, sometimes closer to, you know, the figures were closer than that. But then in 1996, you know, it remains about 2-1. Then the N64 comes along. The Saturn's market share drops quite a bit. It's still being outsold by the PlayStation 1, 2-1. But and by in turn, the PlayStation 1's being outsold by the N64, 2-1 for a few months. which is interesting as we go through, because obviously the N64 didn't maintain that lead at all.
No.
So yeah, and the interesting thing is that come 1997, every region is seeing year-on-year increases in Sega Saturn console sales. So I think in America, it was year-on-year sales performance was up 170% for the Saturn. You know, so you know, you're selling the first quarter of the year, you're selling nearly double the consoles that you sold the previous year, and it was maintaining that. You know, because market share was decreasing, we got to E3 1997, and yeah, Bernie said the line. We can't seem to find him saying the line in a video anywhere.
I wondered if Bernie's basically went on and just deleted them all. Maybe he's that fed up here. Nah. He's like, sack this. I'm getting in touch with everybody. I'm putting a cease and desist out on that line. I've had enough of this. Because I've done a Google search before we came on, done a YouTube search, and I've found the footage of Bernie, you know, talking about DVD coming to Dreamcast as an add-on, you know, which obviously never happened. You know, unveiling the Dreamcast, all these kind of things, loads of Dreamcast stuff, as much Dreamcast stuff as you could want from Bernie Stoller, but that E3 has been erased from the internet. So I think Bernie's done a wee number on that, just a wee delete button.
Quite possibly. If you talk about it, Bernie at E3, then you get taken to room 101 or something.
A single chair in the middle and a light bulb above you. Where did you get that footage?
You've got Winston Smith altering the headlines. But I mean, he obviously said it because that line was picked up absolutely everywhere. I remember seeing it. It wasn't in the official Sega Saturn magazine, or at least I don't remember it being in there, but I did get CVNG now and then, and it was in that. I believe it was someone showed me it in their copy of Games Master, and maybe even in a rival PlayStation magazine. So the line was picked up, and it, you know, far and wide. But you know, far from it just being, you know, maybe he said it just out of turn. Maybe someone asked him a question off the cuff, and he said, "Yeah, it sounds not our future. Not thinking nothing of it." But yeah, the impacts were pretty profound. As a result,
the way it's reported is that he stood up on the podium and made this big grand like announcement. But as you say, I mean, again, maybe one of the listeners who's seen it can tweet us and let us know or drop us a message. But it seems to be this kind of conception that it was almost like his version of the 299.
Yeah,
he just walked up and went, "Saturn is not our future," and then just walked off the stage again.
No, just what would you do that sort of, just walk on the stage and go, "Yeah, the Saturn is not our future. Fuck that thing," you know.
But basically, it could well have been, as you said, part of just, you know, it's not like the media to misquote someone or kind of take a section of a paragraph and just use that. So yeah, I'd love to know the actual context it was actually used in. So if anybody knows, please hit us up. But yeah, I mean, that kind of whole thing was just, you're talking about also the certain gaming media or magazines at the time running with just those words. I mean, I remember in school, it was, you always get school bullying via console choice, you know, because being a Saturn owner in school, Even if you had a PlayStation, you were still a pariah for daring to have this thing. All the cool kids only played PlayStation. Didn't matter how much you told them how good VF2 and Sega Rally were. Nah, Ridge Racer's better. Tekken's better. They wouldn't even play them. You know what I mean? It was a very biased time. We've talked about it as well in the past. I mean, retail, geez, man. I remember getting kind of annoyed because obviously at the time the Saturn came out, it was July 95. So I had literally just turned 16. So I was in my mid-teens at the time. Mm. And there was a shop in Partick. I wonder if Stewie will remember this. Stewie, I know you're listening. Hit me up, mate, because you always seem to remember all the game shops that I went to because we're kind of similar ages, I think. So you must have... I might have even bumped into Stewie once and never even knew. You just never know. But, I mean, it was called Game Zone, and it used to be called the Micro Shop. But whenever kind of that generation of consoles came around, they had rebranded from Micro Shop to Game Zone. And they were across from Kelvin Bridge subway station, or thereabouts. But they were very anti-Saturn. And I just remember being in that shop so many times. My good pal Sam as well. I used to go in there and we would hear it. He'll remember this story. The guy with the big padded shoulders, his big stupid shoulder padded suit jacket that was obviously his dad's wardrobe. And he would literally discourage anybody who came in from buying a Saturn. And it seemed to be whether you went to Comet, you heard it, whether you went to, you know, Dixon's or Tandy or any shop you went into. There always seemed to be this nudging towards PlayStation from the staff. Mm. And again, we've kind of touched on it in other episodes. We don't know if that was maybe a retail deal that maybe Sony had paid more commission to get PlayStation pushed more in retailers. But it did feel back then that you were a very small group of people playing this thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that in a strange way was part of the allure of it.
Yeah.
You know, you felt as if you were playing something that wee bit special that was maybe not understood properly. Hmm. You know, these games that were straight out of the arcade that nobody else could make. And you always felt that maybe people were wrongly overlooking it. So while it was a shame to see people's attitudes towards it, both, you know, in school and obviously, you know, in retail, the joy of owning one back then, it was a special, special time.
Yeah, I agree, mate. That's why I always say it's an exotic console because there was so many fewer of them than there were PlayStations, particularly, you know, in 1997. I had the same experience as you. I mean, we're talking 1996 when I got mine, as I was age 13. Saved up my money all year, got to my birthday, got the rest of it, and went to Currys and picked my console up. And the guy was, "Are you sure you don't want a PlayStation?" "No, I definitely want that Sega Saturn, mate." I know I said the story before. even my mum was saying, "Oh, are you sure this is the one you want? Because this guy's saying you shouldn't have it." I said, "No, I don't want to play Crash Bandicoot. I want to play Nights into Dreams and Virtua Fighter 2." So the retail, the bias or wherever they're incentivized, or maybe because the Saturn didn't give them as much profit because of the cost involved, who knows? But there definitely was staff incentivizing people, urging people to buy the PlayStation in 1996. But it's funny that despite that, the Saturn was seeing increased sales all the way up until Bernie's line. Now, as I say, I remember seeing him say the line in a few other bits of media, but I don't think I really thought anything of it. Like I said in the piece that I put on our WordPress site, the most apparent point to me was when we had Sega Saturn Power magazine. We had a couple of demo discs. We had, I think we had Swagman. We had Reloaded, which was the sequel to Loaded, and we had Fighting Force. One of them was released in a very limited quantities, that being Swagman, and the other two were just binned. Shortly. Yep. I mean, the magazine, the demo disc for Fighting, for the Fighting Force video demo and Reloaded was May 1997, so that would have come out in April, remembering how magazines used to be date stamped back then. It's, you know, after that line, you know, I think it was Gremlin that did those two games. Must have been, well, fuck it. No, Gremlin did, Gremlin did Reloaded, Core did Fighting Force, but yeah, the pair of them, well, bollocks then. They don't know if we want to sell this console.
I mean, Reloaded would have been brilliant. You know, the first Loaded game is superb. Still great fun to play even today. And again, it's not just the games that were cancelled. It's the games that came out, you know, the following year. And you mentioned like kind of reduced quantities of Swagman when it did come out. That seemed to be a kind of trend, you know, that these amazing games, some of which didn't even make it to come out over here, and the ones that did were released in dwindling kind of quantities. Yeah. There was no marketing for them. You know, and we will come back to that bit shortly, but there was just so many great games that, you know, you're thinking, you had the software. You had this in the pipeline. Why did you kill this machine whenever you had such absolute quality software?
Yeah.
You know?
That's the thing. If it really is games that sell a console, then the Saturn had them by the bucket load.
Yeah.
I think it didn't. It lacked the sort of, you know, Zelda and Mario on the N64 were obviously enormous games for the time. You know, there was nothing quite like them. They felt like the future. But then, aside from that, on the N64, it had a very, very narrow library. It was quite small by comparison. On the Saturn, you had pretty much everything. And you had the quality there. You know, you hear it today, you know, people saying, I don't care if the Xbox Series X is more powerful on paper, or you know, Xbox has no games. Okay, well, yeah, then maybe it is the games that sell the PS4, but why didn't the games sell the Sega Saturn?
I think
they could have done. But the other thing was, it's like when you talk about selling games or games being available in reduced quantities, one of the ones that I found maddening picking up recently was John Madden 1998 on the Saturn. You know, that came out the tail end of 1997. Obviously, in the US region, it's common as muck, but in PAL territories, I found that very hard to come by. And I just imagine it must have been released in low numbers, which probably leads us on to the next point, was that this move just pissed off a load of publishers.
Yeah.
You know, you've got third parties cancelling their projects for the system because Sega, because Bernie's line suggests that Sega aren't even that bothered about it anymore. You've got stores reducing the shelf space to the console. And then you've got companies like EA. You know, they probably were a bit rankled that they might not sell as many Maddens and FIFAs on the system. and obviously that played into them, you know, ducking out on the Dreamcast.
I mean, I always remember as well, like going into, you know, HMV in Glasgow and going to the kind of the Saturn section, and it never seemed to change.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it did feel as if at that point, you know, there was a lull in terms of software coming out, which I think was a direct consequence of that announcement, because you see a lot of games would have been canned. I just wonder how many of these games were actually done, because let's look at the perfect example on Dreamcast again. You know, a mirror image situation, almost different kind of circumstances in terms of how it came about. But at the end of the day, a discontinuation caused it. Half-Life.
Yeah.
Half-Life was ready to go. You know, Half-Life was apparently burned and it was gold, was ready to go. The player guides, the official player guides were actually shipped to stores.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to wonder, because I remember that lull and whenever you went in, it just the space seemed to get smaller and smaller. It was like, oh. And I remember you were standing there. I always remember picking up, because King of Fighters 95 or 96 that came out over here?
It's 95 that came out.
It's the white background with the dude's face on it, and it came with a cartridge. And I think that one copy must have sat in that shop for about 6 months. You know, honestly, just nothing seemed to shift. And I think that was other area where it took its toll was on Sega fans also.
Yeah.
Because you've got to think that while the likes of ourselves stuck around and, you know, pined for the Dreamcast and imported one and had that whole amazing experience of importing your first console. There will be, for every one of us, how many walked away? How many went, I've had enough of this?
It would have been easy for them to walk away because between the last Western Saturn release, which was Deep Fear in Power Regions,
I'm
not sure what it was in the US.
Didn't come out.
It didn't, know Deep Fear didn't, so I'm trying
in to... In fact, that there is an example of what I just said. Games that were ready to go and get canned because you can download the US version of Deep Fear, both discs. It's finished. Yeah, I've got it on my Fenrir. And that's done. It's completely finished. It was gold. It was ready to get burned, and then just basically, I'm not going to bother.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, there's a few games, RPGs and stuff. I mean, Working Designs had a few things in there in the oven as well. They were working. I think they were working on the Police Nauts translation. I think they might be that they were working on something else as well. They had a few games that they were looking to bring in from Japan. And I think something that Bernie, they had a bad relationship with Bernie anyway when he came in, and that they after E3 1997, they canned them all. So we didn't have Police Nauts or anything like that come over. Mm. So, I mean, there was a lot of outrage. I remember there was a lot of outrage at Bernie for that as well. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's all his fault. It sounds like half of it is Working Designs themselves. But yeah, it's all these cancelled games. I mean, what could have been? Because, you know, if it had carried on selling half of what the PlayStation 1 was selling, would it be seen as a failure now? You know, if Sega had stuck it out and it lasted till the year 2000. I mean the PlayStation sold 100 million consoles.
So I mean, even if Sega had even sold half of that, it then becomes their most successful console.
I know.
You know, it dwarfs the Mega Drive by 20 million units if it does that.
I know.
You know, because you think back to the kind of two big games that were obviously rumoured, and one we've seen footage of, and it's the right decision that it didn't come, but it's still a very impressive technical showcase that Shenmue was originally meant to be on Saturn.
Yeah.
You know, and that tech demo, I think, is insane. The level of detail in the street, on the character models, the movement, the faces, the eyes moving. You know, I mean, I don't know how many discs if the final game would have came on. I mean, the Dreamcast game came on 3, you know. So, you know, you've got that one. And then there was the long rumoured, wasn't ever officially confirmed, if I can remember, but obviously Virtua Fighter 3.
Mm-hmm.
Which was meant to be another 4 meg RAM cart, or the other rumor was that it was going to come with a cartridge that had additional 3D acceleration in it to help the Saturn run it. Again, the right decision that it did come out on Dreamcast, albeit via Genki, and it gets shat on for its quality and different story and all that. But you've got to wonder how far these projects were down the line.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, you really do for them to can it, and we'll come onto the games probably in a little bit to see if it could survive. But I mean, putting it all into context, you think all it takes is probably one big smash to come and revitalize interest in the console. I mean, we've seen it a few times over the years. consoles that have been flagging, some have recovered, some haven't. But I mean, the Xbox One has been sold 2-1 by the PS4 pretty much since day one, hasn't it? It's going to end up significantly less than 2-1. I think it sold 49 million or something compared to the PS4's 100 and whatever it is.
110 or 15 or something.
Yeah, so it's less than 2-1. So, somehow.
And you want to see a bad launch? if you think the Sega Saturn launch was bad, Jesus. Oh, I still remember watching that Xbox One unveil, and it's like, yeah, so you can talk to Kinect and say, Xbox, TV, and now you're watching American football. This is great. I'm like, fucking show me Halo! show me a game!
It was appalling, mate.
Oh, mate. Honestly, that to me is still that's the worst. And then DRM and Always Online, and even though they retracted it, literally days, weeks, whatever it was, hours, you know, later, the mud stuck with that. But the point that we're making here is that as disastrous a start as that was, and maybe a lot of it comes down to the fact that Microsoft have just got money, like Scrooge McDuck just shoveling it into a furnace. you know, they've got the pockets to do it, but the kind of analogy is the same in that it was a disastrous launch. There was a lot of kind of negative PR, and yet Phil Spencer came in, and the job he's done to rebuild the Xbox brand is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, from software to services to the build quality. I mean, after the 360, the RROD fiasco, you know, they've now got like an attesting Series S's reliability after my toddler sent it flying. Oh, mate, honestly. You ever seen a grown man cry? But yeah, I mean, the kind of parallels are there. But the interesting parallel, and you told me this one, mate, PlayStation 3, take it away.
That was Mecha Fatnik on Twitter told me this one, because I didn't realise that the PlayStation 3 also had a last-minute hardware change. I wasn't aware, and I think this was he linked me to an IGN article about a few years ago. The PlayStation 3 was originally conceived without a GPU.
What?
I'll have to find the article on it. But yeah, it was conceived without a GPU. So Naughty Dog were working on Project Big at the time, which would later become Uncharted. And they had the dev kit for the PS3, and the PS3 was going to launch in 2005 alongside the Xbox 360. And the internal dev teams, according to this article, turned around to Sony and said, you can't release this, not without a GPU. So they took it back, and you know, we're talking about the Saturn not having an additional GPU in it. You know, the VDPs were there from the start, had a new CPU. The PS3 literally had a GPU thrown into it at the def, at the 11th hour. Obviously came out late. Was a little bit of a disaster, wasn't it? Had its own disaster E3. Yeah, Ridge Racer.
My overwhelming memory of that, not just the Ridge Racer. So we're going to go and fight this giant enemy crab. Oh my God, and Govan, man, what was that?
Yeah.
Honestly, do you remember the one-up show that used to be on YouTube?
I don't, unfortunately, no.
Oh, mate, they had, they were like kind of, I'm trying to think of the best way to say it, they were like kind of 20-something, like, it was like kind of, I think Friends for Gamers too, kind of. It's not. They were all kind of like kind of young people gaming kind of journalists, but they had like different segments within their show, and some were kind of like retro, getting back and kind of playing really older games and kind of having a laugh. But they were at that E3, and they were just ripping the price tag to shreds, like $600.
Yeah.
Sick. Anybody complains about the price of a Series S, X, or PS5? $600. I mean, I remember when I got my PS3. I actually sold my Wii towards. I got a Wii and didn't like it, so I traded my Wii in towards part of the cost of the PS3 at the time. But the thing was a heater.
Yeah.
The heat that came out of that. I mean, I remember I was asked on Twitter. Was Uncle Chunt asked me, or just asked in general, what model has the backwards compatibility? And I says it's a 60 gig launch model, but A, they're hard to find, and B, they're hard to find still working.
Yeah,
because I did not need to turn the radiator on in that bedroom that I had that PSC in, because the heat out the back of that thing playing MotorStorm was insane. Not a great piece of hardware at all. No surprise to see that it went through several revisions and eventually get its slim, its own version of the slim.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on some points there, which, you know, not too dissimilar to, you know, what they say about the Saturn is that it was expensive to manufacture. Hello, the PlayStation 3 was very expensive to manufacture, which is why it had the astronomical RRP. You know, yeah. The Xbox 360's got a $250 core model. The PlayStation 3 is asking you to shell out $600 for the machine, and it was still making a loss on each unit. So again, yeah, similar to the Saturn, last minute hardware change. Although I think I feel like that's more significant than the Saturn's, because it's a whole GPU rather than just increasing compute power. Then you've got the fact that it's gone through several hardware revisions. It was also outsold by the 360 by as much as 3-1 in the US in 2008. Which is, considering it had to come from behind, it didn't look good for the PS3 at all.
No.
If you think, when did the PS3 come out? Was it 2006?
March 2006 comes to mind.
So you think? So 2006 for the PlayStation 3 is year one. So that 2006 is it's the Saturn's 1995, then you've got 2007 is the Saturn's 1996, 2008 is the Saturn's 1997, and this is where, you know, things change, because Sony, you know, they didn't drop out of the console race. They didn't say, right, the PS3's not our future. we're going to PS4 now. PS4 coming, September 2009. They stayed the course. Now, again, it's similar to what you're saying about the Xbox One. They have a lot more money. I think when I was talking to Nick and he was telling me this, you know, the cost of what they went through in their losses in terms on the console, in terms of what they were losing on each unit, and what they were losing in R&D to try and redesign the bloody thing, you know, could have funded 10 Saturns. 10, I think were his words. I have to dig the tweet out. But yeah, they stuck it out. They revised the console, made it profitable. Eventually, worldwide managed to overtake the Xbox 360. It didn't overtake it in the US and the UK, but it managed to overtake it worldwide. Which, you know, you've got to give them credit for. They stuck it out for another 5 years from 2008, when they were that far behind, to the point that, you know, even though the E3 was possibly as bad as the Saturn's, even though the launch was probably up there with the Saturn's, and even though the design is probably as bad, if not worse, than the Saturn's, the fact that that they threw this out, this GPU in here at the end, no one ever talks about it, because
the PS is looked upon as a success story.
Yeah,
you know, it's looked as a great comeback system, and I think all of that comes down to the fact that Sony decided to support it with great software. I mean, if you say PlayStation 3, what's the first game that comes to mind?
Yeah, it's Uncharted, even though I'm not a big Uncharted fan, but yeah, Uncharted. God of War 3, fantastic game I'm playing at the moment. What about you?
Well, the one that comes to mind is the one at the tail end. But it's obviously The Last of Us. You know, the God of War games, as you mentioned. Uncharted, a new franchise, was born, which is again endured to this day. Naughty Dog, pretty much, are Naughty Dog the saviors of PlayStation 3?
You could well argue it. I mean, I remember that the game that all my mates had for Xbox 360s, and we were all playing Halo 3 at the time, and no one was even bothered about PS3 until Uncharted hit. And Uncharted, I still don't like Uncharted myself, but I know it's got its fans, and you can't deny that. In, was it 2007 Uncharted came out? Back then, it was an absolutely awe-inspiring game. I mean, it looked absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So that invigorated interest in the console. And I had friends that went out and bought PS3s on the strength of that game alone. And and then they had Uncharted 2, which was critically acclaimed. Uncharted 3, less so. And then, The Last of Us coming out, what was that, 2013? It was the very last exclusive, really, wasn't it?
It was,
It's kind of like Rocky Balboa in the 12th round in the, against Apollo Creed, landing that final blow to the Xbox 360 to just snatch victory in the console sales wars at the last minute for all that matters. But
they scored a last minute winner in Fergie time, mate. That's what it was.
Yeah, they did. King Kutaragi's telling the referee to put four more minutes on.
Ken's at the touchline tapping his wrestler.
But yeah, I think the parallels really are there.
They are, 100%.
And I think it is kind of a sliding doors moment. What the PS3 really shows that Sega didn't have the money that Sony had, but if you support your console, if you keep in it and you give it good software, then it can survive. It could have survived. I truly believe that if Sega had bought some of the key titles that were in development, some of the key titles that were in Japan that didn't get translations, or if it even just put some marketing power and hype behind some of its key titles, you know, what could have been? Those 97 and 98 libraries. I mean, even if we just look at the Western ones, they were very strong, weren't they?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, the ones that we've got here, you think of like Shining Force 3, Panzer Dragoon Saga, House of the Dead, also Deep Fear. These are kind of late 97 into 98 games.
Yeah.
The games that didn't come out as well, I mean, games that were even before this that didn't come out at all, you know, like your X-Men versus Street Fighter, you know, stuff with the 4-meg RAM cart. I mean, where were these games? You know, again, I don't know when the exact release date of X-Men versus Street Fighter was. Did that come? Was that run about the time of the Stoller announcement?
I think it came out in 1997. I think it was around about the time. But
So again, was that planned for the West? And then we've just canned it. So why bother?
Yeah, it absolutely was. Both Sega of America and Sega Europe confirmed that it was coming to the West.
There you go.
Now you got to consider, you know, these are two big franchises. I think Street Fighter maybe was on the wane back in 1997, but people were still, you know, it made me go out and get my Saturn chipped just to play it. as soon as I realized it wasn't coming to power regions, I went and got my Saturn converted to play it. There was that much of a pull, you know, and the X-Men Marvel was not as big as it was now, obviously, but it's still enormous then. You had the Spider-Man cartoon and the Marvel Action Hour and all that sort of stuff. So Marvel was big, you know, those two properties colliding together, you know, in a sort of the first time that sort of crossover had ever been done. You've got a port that, you know, it literally could not have been done on the PlayStation or the N64. And I know there was probably some reticence. There was probably some hesitation to bundle something like a RAM cart in with a game just because of the cost. But you look, was it a year later? Perfect Dark on the N64 bundled with the memory pack.
Yep.
The desire was there. So yeah.
I mean, the thing as well was that for all the talk about Sega not having the money to stay in the race, right, and kind of do the things that Microsoft and Sony did by, you know, standing by their system through really hard times. But I mean, you've got to think of all the inventory that was out there. They had made the consoles, they sold them all at a loss to clear inventory. So, inventory. So, I mean, that's what you've got to question, the fact that, right, so you're killing the machine off, right, because you don't have the money to keep supporting it, but then you're going to basically sell this thing at a massively reduced rate to clear stock ahead of another machine coming out. Where's the logic in that?
Yeah, it's always baffled me as well. The Wii U as well, it was interesting to me because I got one, 2014, I got my Wii U, and I loved it because we're a family of five and it supports five players, and it's still a permanent fixture in our living room. We'll never get rid of it. But I remember looking at it thinking, the price isn't coming down in this thing. I keep telling other people to buy it, and they're like, yeah, I'll buy it when the price comes down. And it remained at the price it was until the Switch came out. You know?
That's that Nintendo arrogance again. Yeah.
But then Sega could have done with that. Sega could have turned them right. Well, we're not selling the Saturn at a loss because, you know, the more set consoles we sell at a loss, the more it's going to eat into our profit margin. Let's just keep it at its RRP and just keep putting out quality software for it, because it's not like they even had to do an awful lot with the software. The software was developed, you know. Just a Panzer Dragoon Saga with a bit of oomph behind it, with a bit of marketing, or maybe just a bit of hype, you know, get your marketing team to talk to the press, you know, an open, as quasi-open world, you know, it wasn't fully open world, but, you know, he had open world environments that you could fly around. You had fully voiced cutscenes, fully voiced and fully acted. There was nothing like that anywhere. You know, the next time that any console would see anything to that quality would be probably the same year, and that would be Metal Gear Solid. And look how that was received.
Yeah.
So Panzer Dragoon Saga did a lot of those things first, especially for an RPG. But it was just, you know, stick it out in, you know, 4,000 limited quantities, 4,000 copies. That'll be enough.
I mean, Panzer Dragoon Saga should never, and I mean never, have had the extent of its marketing to be a free giveaway on Sega Saturn magazine.
Yeah.
You know, as brilliant a giveaway as it was, and it certainly made me pre-order it straight away when I finished that first disc. I think I pre-ordered it with gameplay.com like within half an hour of playing it, because it was that title scene. And I know I've been messaging Andrew as well, you know, since he got his Saturn, and he sent me a video back of the Panzer Dragoon Saga title screen, because I told him, don't even need to play it just now, mate. I went, just put it on and listen to the music. You know, and he went, yeah, that's pretty epic, you know. And again, could you imagine an advert, maybe a cinema run advert with just that score, you know, with some gameplay, just push the thing. Again, Richard Ledbetter did a great job getting Disc 1 on the magazine to even try and raise any form of awareness.
Yeah.
You know, but again, you had the software, the game's there. You know, don't just send it out there as if there might be a few folk that want this. Put 4,000 copies and see how it goes. You know, the most lackadaisical, half-arsed launch of a game, and you're sitting on an absolute beauty of a game.
Yeah.
You know,
all these years later, it's still revered, still highly sought after.
I mean, that's the thing. I could never afford to buy it back again now, not at these prices, which is why I went down the ODE route, because I just want to play it, mate. I know some people, I mean, you've your copy, and we've heard your story about having to get another disc too because of the accident and all that. But, you know, there are means out there that are far lesser in cost than what, you know, the game itself, because you could probably buy a Saturn, a Fenrir, an SD card of the Bifter, and what it cost to buy a mint copy of Panzer Dragoon Saga. But even that, the game should never have been marketed and released to the extent that it became like that.
Yeah, it should have been. And this is the thing that we're trying to say about the Saturn, because I don't think either you or I for a second would expect that the console would win this console war. I don't think it probably wouldn't sell half of what the PS1 did. It probably wouldn't even outsell the N64. But if it was, you know, if it was better supported, perhaps it could have led a longer life. Perhaps we would have seen some English translations of some of these Japanese games, which are, you know, Sakura Wars, Grandia. I know Grandia came to the PS1 in the end, but it's still, you look at the comparison videos, it's still a better game on Saturn. The two Signing Force 3 scenarios. People should be able to play these games, and Panzer Dragoon Saga is a shining example. Right, it's nowadays it's this curio, it's something that collectors seek out and pay outrageous amounts of money for. It shouldn't be like that. It should have been so successful that it's as common as Final Fantasy VII to pick up in CAX for a tenner or something.
Yeah,
that's what it deserves.
It's a massive bugbear of ours. You know, do I enjoy seeing that game change hands between, you know, the retro elitists for several hundred pounds at a time? No, These people, not all of them, but I would imagine a vast majority of them, don't want the game to play it. They want it to sit in a protective sleeve on a shelf and take photos of it and say they've got it, which is wrong for me. I'm sorry if that annoys anybody, but I just think that games are meant to be played. And I think a game like this that didn't get the audience it deserved and didn't get the push that it deserved should be played by a hell of a lot more people. So again, that's why I'm delighted that there is means out there to play it, because without that, without the work of guys like Sed and Terra Onion and all these kind of these guys that do all these these mods to allow you to do it, then these games would be lost. Lost, and apparently Sega have lost the source code as well. Whether that's true, I don't know, but it deserves to be played. It does, from the music to, as you say, it's fully voice acted in Japanese, and you've heard us doing the kind of jokes on here in the past about the Rua
Taicho.
Taicho! But as all these games, the Shining Force Scenario 2 and 3, Grandia, Police Knots. Thankfully, the community has done the work that, Sega didn't, because all these games that we've mentioned have all got English translations.
Yeah.
That have been done that allow you, again, on a modded system to be able to play them. But again, that's the point we're making. It shouldn't have got to that stage.
Yeah,
these are games that should, they were ready, they were sitting there. Okay, translation work might cost a bit of money, localization and whatnot, but the hardest part was done. The games were made, just market them a wee bit. And it's so frustrating, because that lineup that we're talking about there, the ones that did make it over here, like your Panzer Dragoon Saga, Shining Force 3, House of the Dead, it could have been better. You see Virtua Cop 1 and 2, brilliant ports done in-house by Sega. House of the Dead, handed off to Tantalus, who did Manx TT. Brilliant job on Manx TT, passing the checkpoint.
Yeah.
brilliant port. But while it has very sloppy texture work, it has the feel of the arcade game.
Yeah, I think Tantalus could have nailed it, I think, with a bit more time. And I think, again, this is Sega pulling the plug on the Sega Saturn too early.
Yep.
I've said to them, right, well, we're canning this thing in the summer. You need to get this out there. And they were like, oh, shit, well, we can play it from beginning to end. There we go. But, yeah, I think it could have... the textures...
It does look like a tech demo. It does. It definitely does.
And it's great to play. I still love playing it.
Yep.
It looks, the textures are awful. And the mid-level loading, I think, could have been avoided, with a better loading streaming, because you don't get any loading like that in the original Virtual Cop. I know it's not as complex a game, but even Virtual Cop 2, you get very little loading, only when you're choosing a route. So, yeah, a bit more time. And House of the Dead was absolutely huge in the arcade. Massive franchise.
Yep.
I remember when people would say, do you see this new game from Sega? House of the Dead. It's like Resident Evil, but better. Obviously, it was a completely different game. But, that could have been another system seller. House of the Dead, play it at home. It's crazy. Again, another game that goes for hundreds of pounds. About £100 it goes for. Because it was released, rushed to release, and released in very small quantity. I mean, who did that benefit? It didn't benefit anyone.
Benefits collectors now.
Yeah,
that's about that.
Yeah, and Deep Fear as well. Even more, I think that was released in even more criminally low figures than Panzer Dragoon Saga was.
Goes for stupid money.
Yeah, and again, it's a good game. It's a great alternative to Resident Evil. I mean, I do joke. I say it's the best survival horror game released in 1998. I mean, obviously Resident Evil 2, if we're being honest, is probably the better game. But Resident Evil 2 is legendary. Deep Fear doesn't just try and copy Resident Evil. It gives it its own different spin on it. The whole claustrophobic feeling that you have being underwater and the limited oxygen. Really makes it a much more different and exciting experience, market that, you know, push that out there. That's the thing that frustrates me. I think any of these games, the right push could have caught fire, could have reignited interest in the console, like Uncharted did for the PS3, or maybe like Gears 5 did for the Xbox One. All you need is the software, and the software was there. Whether it's one of those games that we did get in the West, which was poorly promoted, whether it is, you know, I don't know, it was Radiant Silvergun too niche. RPGs were big on them. Could the Shining Force scenarios do it? That was, you know, that was a trilogy of games with interweaving storylines and save contents done nearly 10 years before Mass Effect did it. You know,
I mean, the thing with Deep Field, though, is that obviously Resident Evil 2 was meant to come to Saturn again, was taken away, became a PlayStation exclusive. And it's kind of strange that, again, it harks back to the Mega Drive days, where we touched on it in a previous episode, that it was a Capcom one for Radio Sega, where basically Sega didn't, you know, they didn't get the franchises, so they basically made their own.
Yeah.
They didn't get Definitely. Final Fight, so they made Streets of Rage, you know, and much like that. They didn't get Resident Evil 2, so they went, right, well, we'll make Deep Fear. But then they didn't get behind it. Like, no. They got behind Streets of Rage, but didn't get behind Deep Fear. It's the same. So like, part of the mindset still carried over.
Yeah.
But just that last step where they actually decided to do anything constructive with it was just cast aside.
It's maddening when you think about it. The most expensive part of any business really is usually people. You know, and who are your most expensive people? They're your system architect, they're your developers. And these developers have spent, you know, months, years crafting a piece of software just to be chucked out there and forgotten. It's baffling, mate. It really is.
I mean, the end result and the question you've got to ask is, did all of this culminate into the failure of the Dreamcast?
I think unquestionably, yes, it did.
Yeah.
You, as I've said a few times, you give Sega fans 15 months between the last Western release and the new, of the last Western Saturn release and the new Dreamcast console. Their eyes are going to get pulled, aren't they? You know, they're going to get. It's like the old meme with the guy. You know, he's got the girlfriend looking at him, and he's looking at the other girl. You know, your attention's going to get pulled away, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you can't blame Sega fans for doing that, because I chipped my Saturn to play imports in 1998 off the back of X-Men Street Fighter. And through 1998 and 1999, up until I got my Dreamcast, I had to get an import Dreamcast because I couldn't wait that much longer. I was playing Saturn import games, and then I imported my Dreamcast to get it early. So I didn't have a gap, because I was still playing, you know, I was still getting Radiant Silvergun. I was still buying Marvel Superheroes versus Street Fighter. I was still getting the Japanese releases. And then as soon as they sort of started drying up, I jumped onto the Dreamcast. But, you know, anyone else, they're going to go, right, well, what's coming to this console now? Oh, nothing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what do you want for Christmas, little Timmy? Oh, well, there's no new Saturn games around. So, PlayStation 1's £99 now. So get me one of those.
And that's it. And that's a new fan is born.
That's it.
You know, that's you lost a customer straight away.
Exactly. Yeah. So even though the Dreamcast sold well out of the gate, I think the damage was done because they pulled the plug so early.
Because that's why the title of this episode, obviously, the Saturn was Sega's future, because had better decisions been made and had it been supported for longer, then I think the impact that it would have had on Sega's future would have been far, far different.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a very sliding doors moment.
Yeah.
As you say, that 15 months between PAL launches is astronomical. It's a lifetime in tech. it's a lifetime now. It was even worse back then because like the jumps were even bigger, you know, between tech at that point. Your time between like PAL and NTSC launches, it's not like today where a game comes out and it just comes out, that's it, or a console launches. How many countries did we launch in this week? 18, you know, it's like, you know, you didn't get that back then. So yeah, it definitely had an impact. But the irony is that the Dreamcast is so revered, yet ironically it's a bigger flop than the Saturn.
Yeah, because the Saturn succeeded in Japan, but the Dreamcast succeeded nowhere, unfortunately. If the Saturn had retained that audience, I think if they didn't pull the plug, if they kept the developers happy, if they maintained that interest in it, could it have gone on longer? I think absolutely. And then maybe the Dreamcast could have been better. Maybe delay the Dreamcast. Delay the Dreamcast to 1999 worldwide, or maybe even 2000. When did the Naomi 2 board get developed? I mean, that was around 2000. Something that can, you know, go toe-to-toe with the PS2. You know, both starting on even ground rather than the Dreamcast coming out so early.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, it's probably a deeper question, one that we'll go into another time, but do you sacrifice the Dreamcast as we know it to let the Saturn live longer?
Well, I think the Dreamcast audience will be like, no, not a chance. I mean, people may call me to task on saying the Dreamcast is a bigger flop than the Saturn, but the worldwide sales figures, primarily, you know, Dreamcast crushed it in the US, albeit at the very start, whereas the Saturn had a very slow burning, and some would say successful, domestic life. So the bulk of the Saturn sales were in Japan, the bulk of the Dreamcast sales were in the West, primarily in the States. So I still stand by the kind of argument that as buoyed as we were by how well the Dreamcast did and that American launch, and remember Peter Moore revealing the numbers one by one, the biggest entertainment launch 24 hours ever in entertainment history at that time.
Yeah.
But I think at that point, everybody who wanted a Dreamcast had got one.
Yeah.
I don't think there was anybody else left to sell to. And I think that was the problem. And again, that was a result of the fans that they lost by the actions of killing off the Saturn too early. Absolutely, it could have lived longer. The financial implications, okay, if you're talking about finance, then you've got inventory sitting there, as we said, you're selling it cheap. Why? That's you losing more money. You know, you've got the software all sitting there. Japan, the Japanese Saturn library is outstanding. You've got the software sitting there, so use it. These amazing titles that you've got sitting there that you did release, but released it in dwindling numbers, you know, promote them, push them, show people what the system can do. So, yes, the Saturn 100% could have lived longer. And I think we have given a very, very thorough case for the defence, Your Honour.
I think so too, but we'd love to hear from our listeners. What would you guys think? Could the Dreamcast, could the Sega Saturn have lived longer? Could the Dreamcast have been more successful had the Saturn lived longer? Are we way off base here? Do we think that the Saturn was doomed from the very beginning? We'd love to hear from you. Well, maybe not if it's the latter. We don't want to hear about the doom and gloomers about the Sega Saturn. We were positive. but in all seriousness, absolutely. If you could reach out to us at the Sega Guys, or you reach out to me at Swooper_D, or reach out to James at the Sega Holic, we'd love to hear your take on whether the Saturn could have lived longer, could have. You know, it wouldn't have won the console war, but it could have hung in there and retained a few fans, retained some of that goodwill, and maybe Sega would still be around today.
Absolutely.
Cool. So I think that's us then, mate. So yeah, please get in touch, guys, and we'll speak to you all soon.
Ciao, guys. I am off to play some Sega Rally.